brides, grooms, and witches. The witching hour is upon us. And this week we are going to discuss episode 2, the third episode, and we are joined by friend of the podcast and sometimes science consultant, Iraj.
Hello.
Welcome to the witching hour, Iraj.
Hi, nice to see you guys.
So this week, we have kind of a weird episode in front of us, something almost unheard of in Gundam. There's no mobile suit fighting in it.
Yeah, I was not expecting to see that.
Did you feel disappointed?
No, actually. I feel like the focus on the characters and their, I don't know if power relationship is the right word, but the focus on the different networks of pressure that they're under, I find kind of interesting.
Are you telling me that this mecha show is actually about the characters?
Yeah, right?
Unlike
all of the other mecha shows.
No, I mean, it is also very much about the mechas, but they're almost more like a backdrop.
Mm.
I mean, okay, I was super confused when I first watched the prologue of this. Correct me if I misunderstood everything, but this is in an entirely different universe than the Gundam that I've seen, right?
Yes, okay. You are correct.
And so the Gundam here work differently in that they like sap like your energy or something, or they like put your body under stress while you use them, right?
That There's thing... some kind of feedback relationship,
right.
Or it does seem like the Gundam technology, as distinct from mobile suit technology, involves the potential to hurt a person.
It's that thing where becoming a soldier and a mobile suit pilot always destroyed you psychologically and internally,
right?
Eventually resulting probably in your death on the battlefield. Now they've just made that a little bit more direct.
And okay, so then Nina kind of like hinted at this. There seems to be a distinction between mobile suits and Gundam, which seems, again, is like kind of confusing to me, because they're all like, what is his name, Delling, the big bad guy with the cool beard,
Rembrandt Delling,
right, Rembrandt Delling. In the first episode, Rin does his big like Hitler speech thing. His big thing is like, oh, there's something wrong about Gundam. It needs to be like a person who commits the sin of killing or whatever, right? He seems to be like very strongly anti-Gundam for some ideological reason, but then also all of his soldiers are in mobile suits. So I was very like confused about what that was supposed to mean. Like, I guess there's this Gund technology which they don't use.
I don't think we know exactly what the issue is yet. My impression was that there are sort of two things going on. The first one being that this technology represents a huge threat to his business empire.
I know it feels like we're talking about the prologue episode, but actually, listeners, we're talking about episode 2, because really that conflict of what actually is a Gundam, the confusion around the definition of Gundam and what it means and why all of these different people are opposed to Gundams, is actually the central crux of this episode when we get into that witch hunting tribunal.
Because then on top of it, I do think, at least if we can take what he says in that prologue speech at some kind of face value, Delling also has concerns about the potential for artificial intelligence in weapons, and that weapons could have any kind of self-determination or ability to hurt the person wielding them as if by choice.
Although, in the end credits sequence of this episode, they mention AI-assisted weapons, and I think the implication is that that's Delling's mobile suit.
Oh.
I mean, we'll find out next episode when they actually fight, but definitely, like, activates some kind of AI assist.
There may also be some confusion, and I don't know if it's meant to be this way in the show, or if it's a translation thing, or if it's a the times we live in thing. But oftentimes, when we say AI, we don't actually mean, like, an independent intelligence that can make decisions for itself and, like, has a self.
Mm-hmm.
We mean a set of very complex programmed rules that help a thing function autonomously.
Right. You're asking
which is
some
different.
Serious questions. Maybe it's not. You're asking some serious questions about how the human mind works. What is sentience? What is consciousness? Are we not just a complicated set of algorithms for responding to stimulus?
Well, and that even comes up in the episode. They reveal all mobile suits have a permit score.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that there is an accepted range of permit scores, and gunned technology falls outside that accepted range. So it's not even that it has something that sets it completely apart from these other machines. I mean, the damaging the pilots thing seems to, but it has a lot in common with other mobile suits as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Two things. the first one's just going back real quick to that question of like free will and AI versus human minds and stimulus and response. The book that Elan was reading in the prior episode is all about will versus determinism. And I've been told by people who paid way more attention to the opening song than I did that the opening song also addresses that question. So this seems like it's probably going to be a pretty big theme for the show, at least if they manage to pull it off.
One thing I also remember noticing was, I mean, I guess there isn't a fight scene in the second one, but definitely in the prologue in the first episode, in both of them, there's this thing that happens where both the like baby character in the prologue episode and then Suleta in the episode one, they have this like affinity for the machine, right? They're mm-hmm. like, mm-hmm. they can be in there and they just like get it. That gives the machine some sense of autonomy in that it can like or not like the person using it, or that they can get each other. It's closer to a person kind of like being in conversation with the Gundam as opposed mm-hmm. to like someone just piloting a vehicle, right? Mm-hmm. That felt kind of different to me as well from the original Gundams that I was seeing. Like, especially, I mean, in the prologue, the baby just like waves its hand about and then like it destroys all of the bad guys, which is a pretty sick scene. And like the baby doesn't know what's going on and the mom is like surprised, right? So, So it seems like there's a lot of not totally autonomous, but like the Gundams kind of seem to feed off of the vibe of the person piloting them.
I'm starting to wonder how much of that is because as a baby, as a little toddler, it was very easy for her to wrap her head around the idea of the mobile suit as...
Okay, so it is the same person. That also I wasn't completely sure.
We're pretty sure it's the same girl. Different names, obviously.
I'm over here holding the torch for treating it like they're different people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But the as a child, it's very easy for us to imbue inanimate objects with personality and selfhood.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
And that she just never stopped doing that. You know, when they're interrogating her, the way she talks about the Ariel, she says her name is Ariel.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the machine is called the Ariel. It's her, this person.
Her family, her little sister.
And does the Ariel respond to her because she has that attitude?
Right. That's like one of those fairy tale tropes, right? Of like, if you believe that the fairies are real, then they're more likely to, you know, interact with you or trust you. I don't remember what movie I'm like thinking of. It's not Toy Story, but there's something like that happens in some children's content.
I mean, in Peter Pan.
Peter Pan, right. If you have to
believe in fairies.
It.
I do. But does the Ariel respond to her because she thinks of the Ariel that way? Or does she think of the Ariel that way because Ariel responds to her the way a mind would, the way a person would? And so because Suleta gets that response from Ariel, she's naturally inclined to think of Ariel as the kind of entity that gives that response.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to really go out on a limb and say that, you know, this is trying to make a statement about free will and humanity, you can just say that just like with real people, your like experience as an individual of your own free will is much more significant if other people give you that, right? The other people like recognize your ability to make free decisions and like listen to your choices. When you deny someone their like individuality, in a sense, that does like rob them of their humanity in a sense, right? So that's maybe kind of what's happening to the Ariel. If people treat it like a machine, then it's going to respond back like a machine and not really like show them its mind.
And repeatedly throughout this episode, we see Myurine in one way or another being like constrained in her choices and trying to break free of that. She's trapped in this school and she wants to escape to go to Earth. But then in the ending, and when the song is playing and we get the ending visuals, they repeatedly show her inside of a crystal and like able to move around, but still trapped within the crystal. So she has free will up to a point, and it's her desire to break through that.
Well, Iraj, when we were starting, you talked about power, and you weren't sure whether that was the right word, but I actually have a note in here that one of the themes of this episode seems to be power and obedience, or like power and control. Because over and over again, we have the lunchroom scene where they both clearly establish that the pecking order of the school has to do with the power of the company that sponsored you to go there.
Right.
And then we see the very obvious bullying of Earthians by Spaceians, and that some of those young people don't even try to stand up to it because they are too afraid to, because it carries too much risk.
Which is absurd, because a cursory glance at the character designs tells you that the kids being bullied are definitely main characters, whereas the bullies, those are like tertiary or fourth tier characters at best.
Then there's Suletta's arrest, which her questioning absolutely mirrors Camille's arrest and questioning.
Oh, yeah.
In Zeta.
Though her response was somewhat different. I would have liked to see Suletta jump on the table and kick that guy in the face.
Then we have Guel's reprimand. You know, we have seen him on campus bullying everybody as the top dueler in the whole school and getting to have his way, but then confronted by his father, and I deeply resent that they make me sympathize with that guy, but they do. Suddenly we see that while he may have that position within the school, within his family, it's a very different story.
Gosh, I wonder where he gets those behaviors.
Yeah.
I have to say, I really like the way they cut this scene, because we go from Delling putting his like tablet down on the desk, and there's sort of like a metallic clack sound when he does it. And it cuts then into the scene of Guel just having been slapped. And the timing of the cut is so perfect that the sound from putting down the tablet is the sound of the slap.
Right. So it's like interesting mirroring. I mean, the power like theme. On the one hand, there's the very explicit like, again, what's his name? Gelling? Delling, right. His complete control over all these companies, right? Which is in a sense like mirrors the big like conglomerates that were big in, was that as much a thing in Japan as in Korea?
Zaibatsu is right, the term you're looking for,
okay,
and yes.
Exactly. So that very much rang a bell for me. And then that's in parallel with this school where, sure, there's a pecking order and bullies, which is fairly standard. But then at the school, they have this insane system where everything's decided by these duels. Like the school is in some way like mirroring this like really cutthroat environment right under this Zaibatsu type system. Then there's an interesting way that the main characters seem to be undercutting this, right? So I guess there's like the, I forget the name of the mobile suit in the second episode, the one that she's defending.
The Ariel?
The Ariel, right. Isn't that like made by like some kind of competitor company, which Delling is trying to fight?
It's a company within Delling's group that has made the Ariel, maybe. They're kind of doubting whether this company that has never like done anything impressive before could actually do this.
Right.
But it's, yeah, it's like internal politics within this massive umbrella right. that they have.
But yeah, like you said, it's this company that they don't really believe is capable of making a device like this, right? And then again, maybe I'm like stretching this a little bit. But one other thing I found interesting about this series so far is that all of the main characters we're rooting for are girls, right? And they're like physically dueling these dudes, or this one dude. And so there's also a patriarchy parallel there too, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Of like, they're within this system and no one believes that they should be able to like fight the, you know, the main bully guy, and she is seems to be able to do it, right? So that seems to be like a theme that's showing up in multiple places of undercutting these like power structures from within.
I think that's definitely true. The school sort of makes explicit the connection between power and violence. It is explicit and direct, right. Whereas the things get slightly more abstracted once they leave the school, but not completely, because right. that's what the prologue is all about.
Right.
And all the companies we're looking at are like arms manufacturers.
Right.
They're companies, like it's a corporatocracy, but it's all the military-industrial complex.
Right.
That link to violence is intimate.
Foucault would have a field day here, right? It's like the companies are a prison. The school is 100% a prison, like completely unambiguously so. Yeah, it's like patriarchy is a prison. It's yeah, it's kind of, it's crazy.
I read this really interesting paper a long time ago for the first season of the podcast that I think is still relevant, is always going to be relevant. But part of the appeal of these kinds of shows, mecha shows, but also battling shows like Pokemon or Digimon for children, is that they represent a leveling of the playing field. A child cannot physically fight an adult in most cases, right? But if they're both in mobile suits,
right,
the child is not at all disadvantaged against the adult. They have equal physical violent power. And the same thing for like women vis-a-vis men. Mirin is pretty small,
right,
and she doesn't know how to operate a mobile suit, really. That's not what she's studying. But if she did, then it wouldn't matter that she's so much smaller than Guel.
Maybe we can see in that that direct personal strength, even in mobile suits, even in dueling, is not the end of it, because Mirine is able to overcome Guel through forming this like bond with Suleta through community.
Maybe it's something about, I don't know, organizing against the structures of power that oppress you.
But I think it is really interesting that as much as the dueling system is like incredibly stupid, and people keep saying that in the show, it is also the only thing that allows people to overcome the entrenched power structures of the relationships that they're already in. It is only through the dueling that Mirine is able to challenge her father. It is only through the duel that Guel can be defeated.
One of the things that fascinated me in the witch trial towards the very end of the episode is that Mirine is young enough and naive enough to think that power has to play by its own rules. Because when she first proposes the duel, that's what she's saying. She's like, I hate this stupid rule, but you're the one who said it, Dad. Like, you're the person who said this is what we have to do. So, okay, let's do it. And his initial reaction to her is like, I don't have to do anything. I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Like, who cares if I made a rule? Why does that matter?
I actually have in my notes here, why does Delling eventually agree to Mirine's challenge? Because he is in complete, like, she has not actually undermined his authority here. He is still in complete control. Everyone's going to listen to him. He really is correct when he says, whatever I say goes. It's a Gundam because I say so. And like, Prospera, she's like, all right, this is evidence-based science. We know there are three characteristics of Gundams. The permat score exceeds a certain level. There's a data storm, and it hurts the body of the pilot. And here we can see that while the permit score was very high, there was no data storm and it didn't hurt the body of the pilot. So therefore, she makes an argument and he's just like, nah, vibes. I got Gundam vibes from that thing.
Well, some of the other people involved in the trial kind of turn on him.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, I think he's all set to ignore all of this because when he's saying it's a Gundam, it's going to be destroyed and that pilot's going to be kicked out of the school, people look a bit uncomfortable, but they don't say anything. By the time Mirine is done, a few of them stand up and say, yeah, actually, maybe we should let this mobile suit stick around. We'd like to see its test performance. We'd like to use it to either improve our current run of mobile suits or to test new capabilities. He can only afford to off so many people at once before they potentially pose a threat to him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but it's not that they think it's unfair. That, I think that's crucial. What turns them is greed and a sense of an outside threat. Because it's Prospera who says, the group's market dominance is slipping a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't introduce some kind of new weapon, then maybe we will be overtaken by our competitors. And all the other companies start saying, you know, she might be right. Maybe we do need more money than we already have.
I want to know what she offered Jeturk.
Hmm.
That's what I want to know.
Which one's Jeturk again?
Guel's dad.
Right. So I was actually going to bring him up. He seems like he's questioning the power structure a little bit, mm-hmm. right?
He was going to kill Delling.
Right. Exactly. So like, does Delling know about this? And is that why he agrees to the duel? He needs to like buff up his legitimacy or something.
I also think for Delling, I think he might think that this is a way to get his daughter under control. He's confident that he's going to win.
Right, right.
He would never agree to this if he wasn't confident that he would win. But if he engages with her on her terms and he wins, maybe she will stop causing him so many headaches.
Yeah.
She will just shut up and be good the way he wants.
I particularly liked in that scene, they sort of poke at Prospera for wearing the mask at the trial, that it smacks of deception. And her gesture afterwards would, I feel like, have been super effective against like anybody but Delling. She basically shames him. She's like, oh yeah, you have a problem with my prosthesis? Look, I'm missing an arm. She implies that she's missing her face, mm-hmm. that it's just like not there because of Mercury.
And she's on Mercury to get the permit, which seems to be essential for their mobile suits, which explains what we were wondering last week about why go to Mercury. It's a terrible place to colonize.
So against someone who was capable of feeling shame, her gesture would have led to a certain amount of like shame-faced, like, oh, okay, let's move on. Totally ineffective against Delling.
You brought up the Gwell's dad, Jaturk, and his plan to kill Delling in the first episode. And now we've got Lady Prospera, we've got the Ariel, we have a very overt, obvious connection to Shakespeare's The Tempest. And in Shakespeare's The Tempest, Prospero is this this former nobleman who was ousted by a conspiracy led by his brother, who then goes out into the wilderness and discovers incredible power and gets mastery of the spirit Ariel, who does his bidding, et cetera, et cetera. In The Tempest, one of the other major characters is the King of Naples, who was sort of, was like a necessary part of it, but not actually in on the conspiracy.
Wait, oust Prospero or Prospero's brother?
Oust Prospero at the behest of Prospero's brother.
Oh, okay, okay.
Who replaced Prospero as Duke of Milan.
Okay.
In the course of the play, we discover that the king's brother is now intriguing with Prospero's brother to kill the king. Presumably, Delling is the king. Jaturk is the brother. Who betrayed Lady Prospera?
That's actually very interesting. I did not know The Tempest or any of this connection, so that gives it a lot of rich background.
It's all literary as heck.
Entirely unclear what they mean by witch when they keep asking these women, are you a witch?
Well, that's actually something I wanted to ask about, though, because at first I was thinking, oh, maybe that's just a superficial, like, they're women main characters, they're very powerful because, well, specifically Soleta, because she has this, like, affinity for these Gundam.
But they're powerful because of their use of forbidden technology. And any technology which is sufficiently forbidden is indistinguishable from magic.
Right, exactly. So, like, is that it? Or is there more to this witch analogy?
Dunno. We'll find out, I guess.
Yeah. The this is an aesthetic thing from that scene, but I would not have recognized that that was Shadik if his father hadn't been like, Shadik, tell us about the data, because he's in his formal hairdo.
That feels like a producer note. That feels like somebody told them, no one's going to recognize Shadik. You have to include a line where they say his name.
Well, it's different clothes and a different hairdo, so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there isn't much else left, right? What's the significance of Delling's first name?
No idea.
Okay. I was hoping there was another connection to The Tempest or something.
Rembrandt.
Yeah.
We'll figure it out eventually.
Yeah,
we've got
he's
a lot of time
gonna,
to work
like,
on this one.
Paint something or be connected to some art.
So I was thinking more about the school and the dueling and how the school is like a farce of meritocracy, which is like how crony capitalism works. So in the school, in theory, everything is determined by the duels. And so in theory, if you're strong, if you have merit, you can win and get your way. But the actual person who wins all the duels is also the son of the CEO of the most profitable of the arms manufacturers using the best mobile suit designed by his family's company.
Mm. Right. And who has what mobile suits? Who has access to what resources?
The dueling committee seems to be led by Shadik, who is also the son of one of the major CEOs.
Right.
And like, as Choo Choo says, your standing in the school is determined by what corporation sponsored you. And then as soon as somebody comes in who actually breaks the system open, an outsider actually overturns things and becomes the winner, the whole system goes into conniptions as it tries to invalidate the results of the duel somehow.
There's something at the core of this about, like, I mean, kind of going back to the free will thing, like what is merit? What is talent, right? Because if you allow the mobile suits to somehow like reflect the wielder's ability, right, in a way that I kind of get the impression the Gundam maybe does better because it like taps into like who you are in some way, whereas the opposing option is the kind of Delling solution of making these like weapons that are totally kind of independent from who you are, right? So then if you just like have a bigger gun, you're going to win the duel, but it's not really reflecting your ability or your talent or your skill, right? Whereas when you're wielding one of these Gundam, which like clearly some people are much better at doing than others, that might be a more merit-driven duel in that context. But clearly these, you know, corporations don't actually want that. They want to have a full control over what is power, right? They get to define what power is, as opposed to like letting the merit of the people involved like decide that on its own.
And also to justify their own power by being able to point to the system and say, ah, see, my kids are always at the top of the dueling lists, and therefore that justifies their placement in these high positions of power when they leave school. And on an even deeper philosophical level, it's been kind of throwaway mentions, but mobile suit piloting is one program within the school. We've also heard mention of a management track program and an engineering track program. And presumably those people, if they can duel at all, if they're even allowed to, are not particularly good at it, since that's not what they're being trained for. And so the school makes pretty explicit, people who can and do wield violence get to make the decisions, get to have the power.
Well, when Suletta first shows up, that trio of bullies, before they start bullying her, refer to her as one of the elite for being in the piloting program. Those bullies show up again in this episode, and they're kind of starting to fulfill a role.
They're the chorus.
Exactly. They're the commentary. They watch and they comment. But not to spoil things, but Gundam has had observer-type characters before, and in general, by the end of the show, they're not just observing anymore. So it will be very interesting to see what, if anything, happens with these sort of background characters.
Hopefully they get turned. I feel like that would be interesting.
There's certainly a lot in this episode to set up other story points down the way. Not subtle at all, but the hook of that one guy saying, I will never fall in love, and looking sadly into the middle distance.
Elan series.
Who then shows up and is like, I want to learn more about you, Suletta.
I'm sure we're going to see more of him. He's such a creeper. Like, some people watching this get like romantic vibes between them, and it's just like, no, he's watching her like you would watch an insect.
I don't quite get that extreme of a vibe. I get something in between where he also suspects she's using gunned technology, and maybe because it's forbidden, or maybe just because he's deeply curious about and legitimately does want to know more about gunned and about her, but is also kind of weird and standoffish.
I mean, I don't know. The like long lingering shot of him displaying no emotion whatsoever as she's like sobbing and eating, that makes my skin crawl.
This is so funny to me because it's like that, I forget what it's called, but that famous film thing where depending on how you cut something, you can have a guy making exactly the same face. If you cut him looking at a destroyed house, people think he's sad. If you cut him looking at a baby, people think it's a loving look. Like we imbue the expression with feelings based on context and based on ourselves. He is so emotionless in every scene we see of him. That I interpreted it, yes, as observation, but also as he just kind of has a blunted affect, and potentially even that he doesn't want to embarrass her. The impressions that I get of the society in this school is that the kind of quote-unquote weakness Suletta is displaying by crying and freaking out would be considered by many of them embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
And so by not really acknowledging it, he is helping her save face.
But I think if he was going to do that, he would at least like look away. He would avert his eyes somewhat, not just like stare directly at her as she sobs.
But he's in love with her.
No,
get out.
I don't think so. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see.
I feel like if you deny you're in love with someone, it means you are.
I liked his earrings that are like a bell pole. Little tassel fringe earrings. Also, his name, Elan Ceres. Ceres is a dwarf planet in the asteroid belt. Suletta is Suletta Mercury because she's from Mercury. Is he from Ceres?
Oh, that's what I definitely assumed that about his name. Yeah, I think he is.
I hadn't caught his last name. That's interesting.
Oh, he's for sure from Ceres. Also, yeah, why do they pick these horrible places to live in? Like, of the planets in the solar system, those are not the ones you want to go to.
Well, presumably there's a bunch of these, like, colonies, like the one that the school is in.
Just, like, on random rocks in space?
Yeah. I mean, they mention a couple of times in this episode, they use the word front. And the Front Management Corporation, and, like, there's a brief news overlay about an autonomous, like, front zone or something. So I assume fronts are the names of the colonies. They were the sides in first Gundam. They've been plants and the other things in other Gundams, but they're the fronts now.
It's an odd choice, though, because it makes me think of a war front.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely what I... It made me think of war fronts and front corporation. Like the... Yeah, as if there's like some bigger... Right, every company you're interacting with is just like a small reflection of some like, yeah, big conglomerate or some, you know, mafia type thing in the background. So that was the two connections I could imagine.
That makes sense.
I also think the smugglers, the ones who were going to help Mirin go to Earth, represent another faction that we just don't know much about yet.
Hmm. Sure, we're going to see them again. They get way too much like characterization in this episode to just be cast off. I love that Mirine is a toxic gamer, that she's just like,
die.
I assume like she's like the richest kid in the solar system. So I assume she's just a huge whale on these games. She probably drops like the cost of rent like per week on this game.
Who wouldn't if you could, you know?
This episode did a lot of really fun stuff with the low grav or the zero G, both at the spaceport where there are chairs, but nobody sits in them. And Mirin is actually oriented at like 90 degree angles. If the chairs are bolted to the floor, quote unquote, she's like floating with her feet towards a wall. And then with the prison as well, where Suleta is just floating, it looks like there might be some kind of furniture in that room, but she's floating. And the way it's oriented, when Elan comes in, it looks like he's coming out of part of the ceiling. I don't know. I don't remember the exact orientation, but they play around with the orientation of space in these low grav or no grav settings.
Yeah, I feel like the gravity in these episodes was kind of all over the place. It was funny, like I would definitely be surprised in some scenes where it would be like, oh, suddenly this is like a no gravity setting, or like, you know, the school is on this relatively small asteroid, but they seem to be totally fine gravity-wise there. So
some part of the school is spinning, because in a few of the shots, not so much in this episode, but in the previous one, we could see the curvature.
Yeah, there's at least one shot in this episode that shows the curvature of the inside of the school.
No, I didn't pay attention to that.
Yeah, they did science on it.
Okay, fine.
But we didn't invite you here for science, so I can understand that you would not be paying attention to it.
Right, exactly. I forgot all science before I came today.
Thank you. Just as we requested. You can pick it up on your way out.
Yeah.
The best use of the zero G, though, is the scene at the end when Suleta and Mirine reconnect, and literally reconnect with a zero G embrace that causes them to drift into the wall, and Mirine has to like smack the wall to stop them.
Mm. Kabedon.
Kabedon. Classic romance trope of the one character like smashing the wall next to the other one in an intimidating but sexy way.
Yeah, so, okay, there is some kind of, like, romantic tension between the two of them, right?
They're not just engaged.
Wait. Did I just... Yeah, so I did pick up on that, right? They're engaged because Suleta beat...
Guel.
What's his name? Yeah, Guel. Yeah. And again, with the, like, witch thing and the, like, female-centric aspect of this series, is there, like, a pro-gay agenda? Is this show getting woke?
That is what many angry people on Twitter said after that first episode aired.
In particular, to have Mirine point out to Suleta that women getting married is not unusual in this core sort of part of human civilization in the metropole, if you will.
Metropole, that's good.
That sort of thing's totally normal here. And clearly it's not everywhere, or Suleta wouldn't have been surprised. There are places where it's not common or maybe even is unheard of, but here... It's not unusual. It's treated very matter-of-factly.
So I'm going to then ask a contextual question about you guys who know more about Japanese culture than I do. What's the like cultural status in Japan now, more or less, when it comes to the acceptance of, I don't know, gay people in general and gay marriage?
That is a very complicated question.
Yeah.
But it,
we can talk about it a bit.
Is that a thing?
Not on the national level. Within your ward or within your city, within smaller sort of administrative units, there are ways to...
like have civil unions?
To have like a civil union, but not on the national level. They've taken it to their Supreme Court several times and have lost every time. yeah, it's the legal situation is bad. There's a certain amount of cultural permissiveness if it's a quote unquote phase and you then go on and get heteromarried.
Well, that's a big if.
Yeah.
I feel like for most gay people, that's kind of a deal breaker.
Yeah. Well, so it was pretty common at various points in Japanese history for like a mentor or a slightly older person to have a romantic relationship with their mentee or slightly younger person in the context of both of you training as warriors or studying under the same sort of very strict arts tradition or similar
kind of ancient Greece style.
Yeah.
And then if you look at like the pre-war period, the Meiji period, the Taisho period, there's a lot of permissiveness of these relationships within like high schools or high school equivalents, especially like a slightly older student with a slightly younger student. In fact, in some cases, young women were encouraged, like socially encouraged, to get into relationships with other young women because it was like training
safe.
Wheels. It was a training environment to learn how to have a romantic relationship, and there was no danger of anybody getting pregnant or anything like that.
I mean, this is definitely less of a thing now, unsurprisingly. But like in like older like Persian society, there was a lot of in like mentor mentee type relationships, or like outside of marriage, there was a cultural acceptance of this kind of like blurry boundary between friendship and romance, right? Especially between two men. And it's like a very big theme in like traditional Persian poetry. But like part of the like hard line was always, well, that's always outside of marriage, right? Like marriage and family are their own thing and you could never marry a man. And part of that, which I think is kind of maybe progressive, is this separation of like what romance is and what, you know, raising a family is. They're like entirely separate. Right.
The
right?
marriage is...
So utilitarian.
Like social
thing.
And utilitarian. Yeah. Right. Like you have to have descendants.
Right.
And you need someone to run your household or whatever.
And even beyond that, marriage is an obligation to your larger family unit.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that's like a lifetime commitment. It's financial. It's logistical. It's all these things. And so like, if anything, romance like gets in the way of that. Right. So that I understand. And I think that's a thing in many traditional cultures, actually, because people have been gay for forever. But, the thing that I found interesting in this context in the series is that they're explicitly married, like in a formal sense, and they're married for like technical, on a technicality, right? Because she beat Guel in the duel, right? So also Guel's name is basically just duel, I just realized. But it's kind of the opposite. Like, yes, they have some romantic tension between them, but first and foremost, they're like married on a technical or engaged on a technicality. So that's the part I found interesting is like, even if you accept that people can have gay relationships, the fact that like clearly formally it's possible to get married in this universe. And it sounds like that's much less of a thing in Japan right now, I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And it does seem as though this is a microcosm of the way Mirine is trying to assert her independence, assert her free will, fight against the fetters that are controlling her within the like rules that have been defined for her by her father.
Right.
Where she's like found a way to get out of her engagement to Guel without breaking the rules. But as long as she's still following the rules, she's still constrained in what she can hope to achieve. She can get out of being engaged to Guel, but then she ends up being engaged to somebody else. And it seems like she likes Suleta, but she might not. Somebody else could have beaten Guel. Somebody else could beat Suleta. And so I suspect increasingly she's going to see the necessity of breaking the rules instead of trying to use them to her advantage.
That's a pretty mature commentary on reform versus like radical change, right? I don't know if it's deliberate, but that seems to be where it's going in an interesting way.
Alternatively, is part of Suleta's appeal that she is controllable? That like Guel, Suleta is a very good fighter, but unlike Guel, Suleta takes direction. She is not trying to impose her will on Mirine. She is not trying to control Mirine. And in fact, Mirine is able to browbeat Suleta and control her.
Surely it is not a coincidence that Mirine is in the management program. She is managing.
That makes sense.
The opening animation, though, does imply a different kind of relationship between the two of them. The way it's put together visually, there's a one scene that really stuck with me quite close to the beginning. We get a shot of Suletta, and she's sort of like, without moving her body, she's like moving in a circle towards her right, the camera's left, almost like she's orbiting something. And so she goes from looking one direction to looking the other direction. Then we get a shot of Myrine walking and then stops, turns around. So she too stops, turns, looks the other way. And she does so in the opposite direction. They both change their orientation so that they're looking the opposite of the way they were at the beginning and towards each other, it's implied. Then we see quick cuts of both of them, but it only shows one of their eyes and it's mirrored. So it's opposite eyes. And then we see the aerial and it's both eyes looking straight on. All of it together seems to imply that the two of them are essentially like two halves of one whole.
The very end of the opening is both of them sort of curled on their sides as if they each of them represent one half of a yin-yang symbol, which is also cribbed from the Utna anime.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also like, I forget his name, the character in Plato's Symposium who talks about how, like, you know, love is a product of the fact that people used to be, right? Like, people were either male, female, or androgynous, and then, like, were too powerful. So, you know, the gods like, split them in half, right? And, you know, he draws this, like, very funny physical image in that speech where he talks about part of the reason they were so powerful is because when the two people were combined, they could, like, roll around or something. Like, he has this, like, physical image of them, like, being curled up together. Which maybe looks like a yin and yang in the image. I don't know.
There's a great song about that in the movie Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
The Origin of Love?
Yep. Love that song.
One more thing from that opening. There's a shot where we see Suletta reflected in like a shiny glass door. And then the door opens and Myrine is on the other side. And she looks shocked. We can sort of put ourselves into Myrine's headspace and imagine that she was looking at a reflection of herself before the door opened and revealed Suletta. So both of them are seeing themselves and then the door opens and they're seeing the other one. Within me is also you.
Another thing from the opening that ties back to this idea of the show trying to represent in some ways a culture that is more progressive than contemporary Japan. The cast of students is fairly multi-ethnic. Not tons of darker skinned people, but they are represented and different hair, different body types, different skin tones, and that their divisions within the school are not based on race. The divisions have to do with these, you know, earthy and spacian or what company sponsored you, but that race has not been commented upon in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the power structures are still present.
In the same way that there's been no indication whatsoever of any kind of, like, do governments even exist in this world? It kind of seems like maybe not.
Right. It seems to be entirely, like, crony capitalist, like, large companies.
Right.
Corporate
it's all
structure.
These massive corporations. And whatever governments do exist are clearly, like...
subservient.
Exactly. Yeah. So the feeling is, like, the form changes, but power remains.
Yeah. It very much seems to be about how, like, even in this very radically different context, like, power flows in a very familiar way, right? From the bullying to the, like, large companies to the, you know, yeah, the familial tension between, you know, Myrine and her dad. It's an entirely alien situation, but the power relationships feel very familiar.
Mobile Suit Breakdown is written, recorded, and produced by us, Tom and Nina, in scenic New York City, within the ancestral and unceded land of the Lenape people, and made possible by listeners like you. The opening track is Wasp by Misha Dioxin. The closing music is Long Way Home by Spinning Ratio. You can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at Gundam Podcast, or by email to hosts@gundampodcast.com. And thank you for listening. Oh, I need to close the door.
Test, test.
Testing. Noise, sound.
Actually, I'll be right back.
All right.
So me and my roommates, the last couple of years, we've done a bike tour on Halloween Day.
Oh, fun.
Like, with speakers and everyone has lights. So like bike rave mm-hmm. is what we call it. But this year, my roommate that organized it in previous years is gone. Mm. So it's my job to make it happen. And the speaker setup we have is kind of sophisticated. There's like these batteries connected to this amp and everything. And it's been kind of janky. So this afternoon I was going to sit down and test it and make sure it's working all properly.
He really is correct when he says, whatever I say goes. If it's a Gundam, I say so. Let me rephrase that so I don't get angry letters. Say that again, but finish it in like a really climactic final way, because I think that's a great line to end on.
Yeah.
Oh, I forgot what I said.